So I guess we'll go ahead and get started just doing quick introductions. First off, we have Ben Dietz here, who's the VP of Business Development at VBS and Vice.
At Vice. VBS, strictly speaking, is no more. Just Vice now.
Okay. Apologies. Just Vice. why is that?
Oh, can we talk about it as part of the panel?
Yeah, sure.
Awesome.
My name is Adam Glickman. I run theidealists.com. Mary Fajot, who is a creative director at VBH. We have Blake Whitman, who's the VP Creative Development at Vimeo. And Mary Cross, who is the executive producer of content at Click3X Media. So the purpose of this panel, as we were discussing earlier in the green room, there's lots and lots of conversations going on here at South by Southwest, online, in the media, about how the costs are coming down and the tools are now available to let the average person be now a filmmaker. But the other end of the spectrum, how do we enable professional filmmakers, people that are already in the industry, people that are the best at what they do in creating great quality content, to be able to afford to continue to produce the work that they've been producing in this new online world that we live in, this new video world that we live in, where everything is expected to be made very quickly and very cheaply. And to give this a little bit of context and a little bit of history, I was hoping maybe we could start with Mary, because interestingly, Mary was the creative director at Capitol Records back in, I guess it was about 2006 now,
yes.
When the music industry was imploding and YouTube was exploding. Mary was involved with those OK Go videos that were kind of the first YouTube sensation, the first thing to really get traction and take off on the web. But it worked great for OK Go, but from a financial standpoint, I guess from the record label and from the filmmakers, it wasn't seen as such a successful piece of work. And Mary was telling me recently that, you know, from there, she continued to make these short online films, but could never really figure out how to make it work financially. And from a business model perspective, so to speak. So I'd love to just hear a little bit about that experience and what didn't work, but also what did work.
Right. So, so kind of what was going on was I was there at Capitol, and the music business was, you know, tanking, and everybody's scared, and it's really hard to get anything creative through. No more loopholes. Those videos came out, and it was a moment of like, okay, wow, this is a new space of we can really make something happen that people really connect to, and that it's a kind of new creative space that hasn't been defined. It wasn't broadcast MTV requirements of, you know, close-up money shots and that kind of thing. It was kind of like what your imagination can come up with. So I had a production company called Blip Boutique, which I started with a partner director called James Frost. And for about 4 years, we made a lot of video content for online. And our approach was that we wanted to do short-form content. So on the whole, we wouldn't do full-length music videos. We would do series of shorts and just really kind of very loose with it. They were very, you know, artsy music films. And we started to translate to do that some of those for some brands. And
big names in the music industry.
Yeah.
Famous musicians.
Yeah, they were. And the great thing about those pieces was that, you know, it was Robin and the White Stripes and yada yada, and you could get a lot of great people to collaborate with you on those pieces based on the fact that, you know, it was music, it was these artists, and we were doing something that was really different. We were, you know, dressing people in black bodysuits in the middle of the night, covering them with reflective patches, driving out to the middle of the desert and having them run. And who doesn't want to do that? But, you know, over the course of 4 or 5 years, as you build on that, you know, the promise is that, okay, and, you know, brand X or Y comes and they want to build on that creativity, but they don't want to spend any more money. And it's quite challenging then to figure out a way both for your own survival and in order to provide for all the collaborators that you're working with to say, hey, yeah, it was really fun, we did it for the White Stripes, but now, you know, brand X wants to do it and we don't have any more money than we did the last time. So that's a real challenge. And I think what I ended up seeing with that is that there's this huge, huge gulf between that and broadcast commercial production world, and that the models needed to be scaled, and that wasn't happening. So, we eventually kind of stopped, put Blip Boutique in the closet for the time being.
So in talking about the advertising industry, because this is more of a industry insight, but on that side of the equation where the budgets are huge, things are changing as well, because it used to be that the client would say to the agency, here's $1 million to create one piece of content that can speak to everybody. Now it's increasingly becoming a conversation where it's, here's $1 million, but we need 100 hyper-targeted pieces of content. Mm. And the agencies are having trouble grappling with that.
Yeah.
And I think yourself, Mary, and Ben are in interesting places to try to figure out how to make that work for the agency. And I'd be curious if anyone has any insight into that.
You know, Click3X is actually in the process of building out, you know, a big 11,000 square foot expansion with an internal production studio so that we can shoot much more efficiently in-house. And the fact that we have all of our capabilities in-house to shoot everything with our staff, we can handle a much larger volume of work. And I think something that is just necessary now, because you know, in order to work with smaller budgets and more volume, you have to contain everything into one area or one company producing it all. But it's having just the interactive and the director and the studio and the editing and the music composition, whatever it is, all in one place helps us manage that a little bit better.
I think for us, because we're a media company and have been a media company for 17 years and think of ourselves strictly as a voice, right, that and a point of view that speaks to an audience, it's crucial that we have that kind of, you know, vertical capability that Mary just alluded to. We make all of our own stuff in-house. We do that, and we try to make content that is as applicable across all of the different places that it can be. So it needs to be a story in the magazine. It needs to be a piece online. It needs to be cut into a trailer. It needs to be mobile enabled. It needs to be able to generate a series, and it needs to be theoretically the basis for a much larger idea, a feature idea or a DVD or something to that effect, because that's where ultimately the value is going to be derived. We don't know whether that mobile thing is the thing that's going to be the most attractive to a sponsor or an advertiser. We don't know if the feature film is going to be the thing that gets, you know, Hollywood most excited. We don't know if the magazine article is the thing that, you know, a bad example, Al Gore is going to read and go, oh, right, these guys are making a difference. Let's do something. But as long as we're creating across all of those different places and giving the audience the opportunity to interact with them at every instance that they consume content, then we're, you know, setting ourselves up properly there.
So agencies generally call that an integrated campaign, and the idea there is to...
We call that every day.
Yeah, is to have a different production budget for every single mm-hmm. piece of media, whereas it sounds like what you guys are proposing is that how do you take one production budget and make it work across all the different medias, and that makes it more profitable.
Well, yeah, I mean, that comes out of the fact that when we have come from a place where you had to do everything for whatever money you had, right? And... So it's the natural sort of expression, right? There's always a photographer on a shoot. There's always a writer on a shoot. There's always somebody shooting video. And this, I mean, it comes out of something that Spike Jonze said to us 2005. There was an article in the magazine, and Spike said to Shane, our CEO, he said, so what are you guys doing with the video that you shot around that magazine, or around that article? And Shane was like, oh, yeah, you know, it's in we'll get to it at some point or another. And that was total bullshit. There was no video shot, of course. But we immediately went back and said, oh, right, we have to be shooting all of these things. We have to be capturing all of these stories. The first expression of that was the Vice Guide to Travel DVD, where we essentially went to film school trying to cover stories in the magazine that, had never been captured in video. And I don't know if anybody's seen the Vice Guide to Travel. It's a kind of wonderful document of a moment in time where we didn't know how to make films, and we didn't know how to answer any of the questions that we were asking, but we kind of, they were provocative enough that we got away with sort of not answering them. But that was so from that experience, then we had a conversation with Viacom. Viacom said, we need an incubator for content that we're going to put on television. We said, give us a bunch of money. That's what started VBS, right, which was originally a joint venture with them, and which we brought into Vice.com last year in September because, A, we bought Viacom out, and B, because we didn't need to have a separate extension anymore of the Vice brand. We could just do everything under one roof. So that's why there's no more VBS.
But all the content... but all the content advice is, I mean, you guys are a traditional media company in that sense, and that you're ad-supported.
Yes. Content. No, and that's... Well, no, but that's... That's crucial, though, because mm-hmm. we're not only ad-supported, but we have always been free. The magazine from the very first has always been free. The content online has always been free. And it's a little different than a traditional media company, because traditional media companies drawing from multiple revenue sources. They've got subscription income. They've got advertiser income. They've got, you know, what you might call that integrated kind of income. They you know, build events and all that kind of stuff traditionally. We've always needed to be relying on that one source of income, which is essentially brand partnership and advertising. Mm-hmm.
Is there, and this is maybe a question for Blake, but is there a third way outside of ad-supported content? Because we're all in this place now where we're used to content being free online, and someone's going to have to pay for this stuff out. If it's either going to be advertisers, or are we going to start to see more micropayments, subscriptions, things of that nature? Is there a viable way to get work created outside of advertisers?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to evolve, of course. If you just see some of the test cases of, like, the Louis C.K., you know, he put his one-hour special online, and it made tons of money right away. Not everyone is Louis C.K., not everyone has that audience, but we were talking about in the green room about building an audience for you, for your company, for your production arm, whatever it is. When people begin to expect to see quality work from you, we see that just on Vimeo in general, several music video directors, short film directors who just make quality stuff every single time. And when they put it out, people are expecting to see something amazing, and they watch it and they share it. And they've gained this audience and this sort of cult following, bigger than cult following in some cases. And that allows them to just have this sort of built-in audience, which is really important, which maybe in the future they could potentially monetize in some pay-per-view type of way. But unless you have the big sort of advertising dollars or, you know, there's a lot of exposure to potentially what you could make, not necessarily everyone's going to be able to just throw, you know, a film in iTunes and sell it for $2 because no one knows what they're going to get. So you need to have some way to advertise what you represent or promote what you represent. And for us, a lot of it's just building this sort of social capital or this creative capital, I guess, on what you do and how you do it and being very open about it, because the people who are more open tend to do better. They have a larger audience. And there's some really good examples of that, but it's still this, you know, giant testing ground right now. I think it's people are experimenting, you know, You see YouTube working with Sundance and the pay-per-view model there. Those are feature films. The short film stuff, I haven't seen a lot of people selling short films online because they're always expected to be free for some reason. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know when that's going to change. I think it will, but I'm not sure when. I think it depends on when the audience starts to see and understand that the quality is there, because a lot of that is based off of what people are going to expect to see. But it's hard because there's so much out there. How do you...
Now, would it be possible in the future to... Do you see a future where there might be a very well-curated Vimeo channel where you take the best of the best, but like your own version of HBO, where people have to subscribe to that?
Yes, I do. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, that's a kind of a natural evolution for us. Mm-hmm. We're a subscription and advertising-based model. So if we can provide value for subscription for content as well, that's going to be a huge win for us. And it may be something we explore in the future, but, you know, we're focused very much on the uploader and the people who want to share and providing them with the tools to do that. The other side of that is we get incredible content. And so we're not a content company, but it would be natural for us to become that in a sense. And so, yeah, I think the opportunities you know, hopefully relatively soon will present themselves for that. But again, we are a huge platform. So, you know, we're growing tremendously year over year, and we have that ability to promote content. When we feature videos on our homepage, they provide a ton of exposure to people. And even, you know, days later, these people get contacted by production companies. And, you know, there's a really great story of a guy made this amazing Rin Tin Tin animation on Vimeo, and it blew up. We featured it, and he was called by Spielberg 2 days later. So that's incredible. That doesn't happen every day, but that is from zero to hero in 2 days because of the quality of the work and because of the exposure that that person's getting. But again, it's a, I think in the future, as people you know, utilize the platforms and utilize the tools that they have to promote themselves as much as possible, opportunities present themselves. And again, we were talking a little bit about this before, is that the bigger the audience that you get, the more opportunity when you're exposed, or when a production company comes to you and says, you know, will you help us? Sometimes for those people, they've only known about how to make these things for nothing. And when someone says, here's $10,000, you're like, oh my God, $10,000. No one's ever paid me $10,000. Like, what am I supposed to do with this?
Take a bath in money.
Yeah, take a bath. Just
put it all in a bathtub and take a bath in it.
Yeah. But, you know, and that's exactly. That's where this whole shift is coming from, this giant, you know, huge budgets. When you can seed someone with $10,000 and you know they're going to make something incredible, even sometimes bypassing the agency, that's where things get totally shaken up, right? And that's kind of the issue now, is that you expect to do such incredible work for such little amount of money, and that a lot of people are very hungry to do that. They want to do that because they've never had that opportunity before. And it's really bypassing a lot of the sort of middle ground there for the established filmmakers and the established sort of agency / production world. It's great for people who, like, you know, the
control distribution
on Vimeo. What?
I was sort of thinking about a number of things while you were talking, but the ultimately what we're saying is that pro filmmaking, because of the reduction in cost of great gear, right? Like, not anybody can go buy a 5D, but if you can buy a 5D, you can make a pretty amazing looking film.
Yeah.
Anybody has access to a wealth of content. Every director showreel, every movie ever made, all of this stuff is available digitally at the click of a button. And everybody has a point of view, right? Everybody individually has a point of view. It may not be particularly distinct yet, right? Because it needs to develop, but everybody's got that. What everybody doesn't have is distribution.
Mm-hmm.
And that's ultimately the thing, right? And what Vimeo does, and what YouTube does, and what theoretically media channels like ours do, is create distribution for all of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It puts the agencies in a weird spot, because if everybody can create and everybody has an access to distribution, then what is the sort of agency model? And then the agencies start saying, well, we need to own content. And the same, I'm surprised, I'm interested to hear you say you think you're going to be a content company.
Well, the creation of content is one thing. The distribution of content is another. And so we could do both. But, yeah, I mean, we are sitting on millions of incredible films and videos and even new types of content that people are just kind of creating out of the abundance of creativity, just kind of compounding on itself, and because there's new audiences for new types of content. And that's, to me, really interesting, because it's not the old world. It's you know, when you see an amazing time-lapse film, or, you know, these personal sort of video blogs or explorations of just personal life, and it becomes content. You know, it becomes something inherently very creative and interesting and beautiful. It's not based in a, you know, traditional film sort of vernacular, I guess.
I just want to jump in with something really practical from, like, the standpoint of a creator, which is that, like, yes, there's major distribution. Yes, you know, everybody's a hybrid. They can edit, shoot, and do everything themselves. And it's a wonderful world in there. When one of your creators gets contacted by a production company and says, yes, here's $10,000 to do something great, it's that person who's the filmmaker probably wants to continue to do that forever.
Right.
They want to be a filmmaker.
Right.
Why else would they do that? But they're not going to be able to do that forever on $10,000 over and over and over. And
yep.
Their friends who help them out are not going to continue to do it for nothing, and et cetera, et cetera. So I'm just being really realistic, is that I think what the problem is that promise is a wonderful promise, but it doesn't necessarily pay off, and it should. Like, for example, I have a friend who writes music for commercials, and he gets, you know, 6 big jobs a year, and he's set in the commercial broadcast world. But he would actually rather be working all the time in some kind of middle ground hybrid situation. But that doesn't seem to exist right now. And I think that's what should happen. And there's a lot of things around that need to happen. You know, now I'm at BBH in LA, and we're trying to create a different kind of a model in as far as the people that are there are hybrid creatives. We're more of a content-oriented agency as opposed to a traditional agency geared towards doing broadcast commercial production. So I think those kind of inherent structural shifts on the agency side are important. It's really important for the client to understand that, yeah, you can go get that kid to do that thing for $10,000, but that's not really right. You know, you really, there should be a scalable situation where some of the really high-end broadcast production, which is filled with fat and filled with unnecessary costs, should come down, and then some of the content that gets created for online or elsewhere, the models, the budget should come up so that people can actually, you know, make a living at that. It's important for creatives to be able to make a living.
Unions also, that's, I think, the thing that needs to be talked about a little bit, is they are going to need to reassess what a fair budget is.
Yeah, that's huge. I mean, just talent costs.
I assume, Mary, this is something you deal with a lot, Polly.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, a lot of ad agencies are SAG signatories, and so it, a lot of times we'll have a really small budget for a video, and you look at what the talent cost is versus the production cost, and almost the entire budget is eaten up by talent sometimes when you have a really low budget project, because there's, you know, those are fixed costs that you can't really do anything about. Yeah, I mean, the web videos, I mean, there are, you know, you can get it's lower than broadcast rates, but it's still a big cost.
And Adam, I think it's important to talk kind of what Idealists is doing as well, because I think that's an interesting model in a sense.
Okay. Well, I think so too.
Thank you. Well, then I'll take this opportunity to self-promote a little bit for everybody. I run a startup called The Idealists, I, like Mary and Ben, I started in the publishing world where you would have to be very scrappy. When you'd have an idea, you'd have to get it done on a very small budget, and generally that would mean, for me at least, as a magazine publisher, going to one of my advertisers, who basically became our patrons, and saying, let's partner together in this idea to figure out how to get it done inexpensively in a way that's going to benefit us both, and we're both going to get return on the investment. From there, I went to the advertising world after selling the magazine in 2007. And when going inside the walls of an ad agency, it really astounded me how much money there was, yet how hard it was to get things done because of all the layers. And so in trying to figure out a better model where things could get done more efficiently, I created a website, and probably the easiest way to think of it is Match.com for client needs and creative solutions. So what's been interesting is where the site has really taken off is people needing to get low-budget online films done, and doing so in a way that doesn't become a kind of a crowdsourced race to the bottom where you can just really exploit filmmakers. How do you do so in such a way that the filmmakers are getting value and the clients are getting value? And what we found is that when you put out a job to a community, there's always people that are going to be interested in the job based on, sometimes it's the budget, I just care about the budget, is it going to make me a lot of money, that's all I care about. Sometimes it's schedule, I'm not busy this week, sure I'd love to do that project. And sometimes it's just purely creative. And for us this model works because, to Mary's point, you can't every time be pulling favors, but if you have a community of filmmakers that are interested in projects for either quantifiable or qualifiable reasons, there's always going to be someone that wants to take that job.
I think a lot of those projects, I mean, I feel like for some reason someone somewhere thought, a video costs $10,000 no matter what, and that just seems to be everyone's budget. And
yeah, wait, what? It's, that actually, no. Well, you know what it is? It's that's the exact amount of cash you can fit in a bathtub. That's why.
But, I mean, even at $10,000, you know, to an amateur filmmaker, maybe that does seem like a lot because they're used to doing it for themselves and calling all their favors, and they're not used to, they're not a business and they're not meant to be making money. But for a professional company who's, we're not doing this for free, we're actually meant to be making a profit, that's almost impossible unless we're pulling favors. And I think that, you know, when a lot of these branded projects come through at $10,000, usually if we're going to take it, it's because it's opening up a relationship or it's giving us, you know, it's almost like rather than doing a spec spot that fills a hole in our reel, it's, you know, it's a paid spec spot. We're still not making any money on it, but at least we're getting something creatively out of it, or a new relationship or something else. But
I wonder how many films are created out of creating a new relationship, you know. It's probably
I guess it's
amount.
Like, you know, I think, you know, I always wonder, too, if you do a job cheaply for the first time to open up a relationship, how often can you really get somebody to open up their budget for the next time around?
Right. The interesting thing about super inexpensive pieces, that if we're talking about brands, right, is that the brands expect to have a voice, a point of view, a presence, and they expect this stuff to be created in a way that they're accustomed to, right, which in working through big agencies in the past has meant that there's been a dish of M&Ms and that there's been a can of Coca-Cola in some kind of edit suite that has leather couches and shit. The reality of it is that that's not possible on the $10,000. And we used to think that it was a kind of a liability, that we were called vice because that meant that big companies didn't want to sit next to us. What we've realized is that that was a huge advantage, because it meant that we would say to companies, look, you can only work with us if you can sit next to Vice and if you can deal with our point of view on a subject. And we're going to make the right piece of content for our audience, which is going to benefit you, which is going to benefit the audience, which is going to benefit us. The advantage to you for that is because we don't have the dish of M&Ms and we don't have the leather couches in the edit suite. We can do this a lot less expensively. And I think that's we're in that transitionary period where brands are starting to go, yeah, you know what, I don't actually need M&Ms. M&Ms are awesome, by the way, favorite candy, but I don't need the M&Ms and I don't need the leather couch. As long as I get a preview link to this thing on a regular basis, I don't have to be as involved in owning this thing, because they see on the other side of the table consumers who are out there going, I love M&Ms or I hate M&Ms or whatever, and they have no control over that at all. So they're kind of like, yeah, we'll just let the Vice guys do what they do because it'll be the right thing for their audience.
I think, though, what I find more often is that the budgets are coming down, but they're still expecting the same service that they were getting with the big budgets, and that's what's really difficult to manage.
Yeah. M&Ms wins in any case.
Well, I'm curious to talk a little bit more about outside the advertising world. We see there's a bit of this kind of classic conflict between, you know, distribution versus content, which is king. And right now, the distributors seem to be the ones that are kind of holding the cards, YouTubes, the Vimeos, the Googles. And it's interesting. I mean, I think we can talk about this, right, what YouTube is doing with their channels. It's public.
It's not only public. They've launched. A bunch of
them
have launched.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, I'm wondering, are technology companies or the people that own the distribution, are they going to be the new studios, possibly? Is there legs to this thing that YouTube...
Well, I mean, they certainly want to be, right?
And I don't know if everyone here knows what YouTube is up to with these channels they're launching. Maybe you could talk a little bit about it.
So YouTube has invested tremendously in creating a series of premium content channels where they've given money to content creators across the spectrum, from big sort of broadcast news networks to us to just people who are really good at cat videos, basically. And they're looking for those channels that have legs, that can create audience, can create value for YouTube. YouTube sells advertising against them. That's how they amortize their costs. But they're looking to create super channels that make YouTube a destination and that create value for their advertisers and for their audience. With the ultimate goal, of course, of saying, look, we're taking eyeballs away from cable television, we're taking eyeballs away from the major studios, we're taking eyeballs away from video games or whatever it is.
But it's a revenue share, right? So they give you X amount of dollars, and then to produce content, and then when their costs are recouped, then it becomes a rev share?
That's correct. Yeah, that's right.
So that seems like, if it can work, fantastic for everybody, right? Great content is getting created, and everyone is making money off of it. But does it become so much of a volume business that it becomes hard to actually make great content?
I don't exactly get the connection between the volume business and making great content.
Because in order to sell that amount of advertising at a couple pennies a pop, you're going to have to make a lot of content.
No. Because remember that there are it's about the quality of the content and how well it resonates, right? Like a single video can be, as is the case with our Noisy channel. We premiered the MIA video the weekend before she went on the Super Bowl. That video has done 13 million video views on that YouTube channel. There are a bunch of other videos that are gaining momentum, but really there are huge spikes that can achieve the scale that you want. Mm-hmm. The real challenge more is finding the right mix where we are making the content that speaks to our brand and speaks to the audience. YouTube has the team that knows how to take this to advertisers and package it in such a way that it makes sense to the advertisers across all of these different channels, and also that the audience feels like they're being served, right? So it's not really a question of quality versus scale. It's more a question of all of those three pieces coming together, which is really
And I'd also add it's important to
here.
Sort of distinguish what type of content that is, right? It's very serialized. It's very, you know, you're expecting this audience to come back. If you're a filmmaker that's making one-off films, that channel isn't necessarily the best for you. And your content is Vice's content is great. It's sort of a hybrid in the sense where it's very creative, it's very interesting, it's informative, and sort of groundbreaking in a way. And it has a really great audience. If you're just a filmmaker making one-off short films or maybe a little longer pieces, you don't necessarily get that channel on YouTube. No one's going to pay you that money because you don't have that cachet, you don't have that audience, right? And so for Vimeo, we focus on the individuals. We don't focus on the big brands and the big companies. Even to be on Vimeo, you have to have created the stuff yourself. We don't allow the redistribution of mass media content. So it's also we've really focused the audience to expect something, and this expectation is what we've been building for 5 years. And so when you go to YouTube, there's a certain expectation as well, what type of content you're going to see versus what you may see on Vimeo. We focus much more on the creative spectrum side of things, but you know, we can't necessarily pay tons of money to a bunch of creators to create short films and then just throw it out on these channels, because that we're not just a solely ad-driven model as well. And because a lot of these channels that YouTube is investing heavily in, they have names behind them. It's like the Snoop Dogg channel and the Vice channel or whatever it is. And,
it's funny you'd put the two of us together like that. More on that later.
But so, again, it's about sort of trying to establish that audience and what their expectations are and what are the opportunities for filmmakers to create the sort of one-off pieces that they really want to make and have an audience. Film festivals are one way, but online is much easier, and so they're trying to figure out a way to get that out and then somehow maybe make money or somehow get an opportunity from that. And there's no clear-cut way to do that right now. I think people are still trying to figure that out. If we can potentially help at least build the audience first and foremost, that's going to be the first step. And then in the future, potentially, the different opportunities that present themselves, like pay-per-view, or even, you look at the Kickstarter model, which is amazing. People are funding creativity. They are interested in helping provide, the means for filmmakers and creatives and artists to do what they want to do. And so, it's almost like micro tipping in a way. Is that something in the future? If you're like, oh, I we have a like button, I like this and I donate 10 cents or $1 or whatever it is, just because you really appreciate that and you want to help fund that and keep that going in the future for that filmmaker because they do really great stuff. I don't know.
You guys ever tried a tip jar? I mean, I remember that you used to see those on sites and it never really took off. But
yeah,
it feels like now that everyone's
We haven't done it. We may do it in the future, but it's its own can of worms in a sense. But people want to help facilitate people to do good things. I donate on Kickstarter all the time. or not donate, help fund, I guess. And just because, like, you see these things and they're so incredible, and $20 when at scale goes a really long way. When, you know, you have 10,000 people or whatever, you know, I think they, Kickstarter just had their first $1 million funding, like, a couple times, like, a couple weeks ago?
I think two.
Two of them, yeah.
No, that's $2 million.
$2 million,
yeah, one project.
That's incredible. Like, yeah, and that was done in such, you know, it's like a 30-day period or whatever it is. That's insane, you know? Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, there's this whole democratization. If everyone wants good stuff and can help contribute to it, then you're going to get it back. And that's sort of the film karma or something in a way, which I think is a beautiful ideal model, whether or not it scales. I mean, I think that's a big question. But just the fact that now filmmakers can get the initial push to go make what they want without having to go to an advertiser or going to their mother or something, then, yeah.
Number one advertiser in the world.
So, yeah, I mean, those are really cool. I think it's just a really interesting time right now. I know that's very vague, but I think the opportunities will present themselves when we start seeing individuals really kind of nailing it, or distribution companies or whatever it is, and people like actually see the value there. So I don't know.
One thing that I'm personally missing and I would love to see a resurgence of is the music video, because it seems like now there's so many places to watch them. I mean, understandably, the people that used to pay for them don't have the money to pay for them anymore, i.e. the record labels.
Yeah.
But is there a way to start funding great music videos, because it's so cheap to make them now and there's so many places? And that's where I go to Vimeo, is to...
Yeah, we have tons of amazing music videos, actually. And I think, you know, that's... music videos are often... filmmaker's first foray into film, I think. You know, they have a friend who has a band who wants a video, and you're like, all right, yeah, I could do this. And you get into it, and it's a very... It's easier because you're not necessarily dealing with sound and with story. You can kind of, you know, go all over the place, and it's just a little bit easier to put together. But it's also really interesting because the audience is now much more appreciative of a variety of types of music videos, where you see, you know, hackers connecting or hacking Kinect boxes and doing like really crazy stuff. They're fusing tech with music video and art, just straight up like crazy weird esoteric artists working with musicians to create something really crazy but very cool. The audience is more appreciative, and I think it's expanded in what is entertainment and what is quality, just because there's so much more of it that it's been able to bubble up, I guess. But yeah, I mean, I think the music video side of things is really interesting because it's not the MTV model, you know. If you have a band and it's attached to an incredible music video and that somehow gets a lot of exposure, it's really great for the band. And even on the Vimeo side, it's really great for the filmmaker because, in a sense, the filmmaker is part of the star as well.
And you've been making some interactive music videos, right?
Yeah, and I think, to contradict myself, that might be the one area where you could call in favors forever, because it's innovation, really. Mm-hmm. Like, you're creating formats that didn't exist before, and that the kind of payback from that is valid, I think, because those pieces get not only, you know, real attention, but also they're groundbreaking in some ways. And it's not the same. You can't say that's the same thing about a video, format-wise. Of course, creatively, you can always be groundbreaking. But, yeah, so, done a few things with Robin, more specifically, using Twitter and some live remixing with, like, sound and video simultaneously. And that's a very cool, fertile arena that I'll stay in.
I think the challenge with music video, though, is that because music is a passion point for young people, it's going to be something that there will always be an appetite for. The difficulty, the reason MTV worked, is A, it carved out a place or created a market that didn't exist previously, and B, because brands wanted to get involved and wanted to sit next to that. because the cost of production on music videos has come down so much, and because that sort of monopoly has been broken up, what brands are looking at now is the ability to create and fund music videos themselves. So they can do that, right? We're talking to a brand for whom I think we're going to work with a bunch of great filmmakers to make some music videos in the next year or so. And that'll be it's going to be a great project. Those things will go live on the brand's Facebook page. They'll live on Vice. They'll live on the sort of social distribution platforms that we use. Where they won't live is a kind of monolithic music television channel, right, or music broadcast channel. That kind of monolithic music broadcast channel is going to have a hard time existing in the future because it's going to be very difficult to get brands to essentially compete with their own marketing budgets to fund the advertising at a large level when they're paying for the production at a small level and even potentially owning some of that production.
But Vice has started producing music videos.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. No, but I'm saying Vice is never – we're never going to be a music video answer to MTV. Noisy, mm-hmm. our live music video channel, will always document live music around the world, mm-hmm. but it will it's not meant to be a channel that is the place where music videos created by other people sit and live and as a constant kind of open door for those things.
Okay, if you think about it, though, MTV is such an incredible anomaly because they basically said, like, here's our channel, you guys make the content and pay for it, and we'll just play it. You know,
like, no, it really is shockingly.
Right, but we're talking, like, the production on music videos got to such a place that, like, the quality of what they were, playing was obviously pretty high. And
I started my career at Sony Music, and I worked in the music video department for a while. We literally couldn't make a video for under $250,000.
Right.
It was impossible.
That was that time.
It's the truth, right? But 1999, good time to be in the music
video
business.
What? Capitol Records was not happy with what OK Go was up to.
Well,
right?
it wasn't really a video. It was like basically what the before the treadmill thing, mm-hmm. they were dancing around in their backyard. Mm-hmm. And that was like rehearsal for something that at the end of every show they would do this dance thing. They would like play the song to track and they would dance. And I was actually going to have a meeting with a video director who had an idea for a choreographed video. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay, go in the backyard, throw the camera on the tripod, record yourselves dancing, and I'm going to swing by in a couple of hours and pick it up, and I'm going to New York to meet this guy. Mm-hmm. Okay, so they did that, and then we do that, and the meeting doesn't happen, and then I've got this DVD back then, but and
wasn't
and,
on 3/4,
and start showing it around to people, and everybody's like, "Oh, that's the best thing ever!" All that. And so finally, we were like, "Yeah, that's the video. That's it. That's the video." Mm-hmm. But the label was like, "Shit, production value. They all look like crap. There's no way." And it was like 3-4 months we were fighting about it, and essentially they played a show across the street from the label one night. They did the dance live, crowd went ape shit, and then big record label guy, "Hey, you still have that DVD?" And finally they put it out. So that was how it happened. I mean, it's all in the air, sometimes it's just in the air, and like you just shoot it and it flies.
Interesting. Well, I wanted to ask one more question before we open it up to questions from you guys. But one of the themes that's come up a couple times over this conversation is generalist versus specialist, and that moving forward, the generalist is going to be getting more and more jobs, and it's going to be harder and harder for the specialist. And you made the observation that that's the only way these days that you can really see production.
Yeah, I mean, I was at a smaller production company where more like a traditional production company where you have a small staff and everyone is freelance, and in order to finance a project you have to that's a good model when you just have a lot of projects coming in and you can hire specialists for each and every project and not have a huge overhead, but it also makes it very expensive for each project because you're hiring out freelancers for every single one. But if you have people who either are hybrids, or if you just have, a staff where you can actually, you have enough volume to come through where you have everybody there, then you, and packaged together, you can handle it a lot. You can do it a lot cheaper because you have the volume.
I just think everybody who's under the age of 30 is a generalist anyway, just by their sort of
hybrid
generalist, however you want to put it. But they're you know, wired to think across platforms, wired to think across capabilities, and have technological access to, you know, the means to create this stuff. So I think, you know,
so we're dinosaurs.
No, I don't think so at all. I mean, as a matter of fact, I think this panel probably represents people who were generalists or were hybrids before there was a call for us to be hybrids. But I think we're going to increasingly move in that space, and that's really where the sorting out is going to happen over the next few years is finding the place where this kind of generalist capability and impulse and instinct, right, from a younger generation meets the fine-tuning and the brand voice and the polish that the older generation has developed over the course of time, which is, I think, this is the other big gap.
Well, I don't think it's even so much an instinct to be a generalist, but a necessity, because you have, especially on the commercial world, you have a couple A-list directors who can demand a certain day rate and can get booked a certain amount per year and can be fine just doing what they do. But for everyone else, in order to stay busy and to stay working throughout the year, sometimes they're the director and sometimes they're the writer and sometimes they're the producer and sometimes they're the editor and they're helping their friends out on their film, and they're always busy and always working doing a variety of different things, but they're not always the director every single time. And I think that's just the only way that they can stay busy. Otherwise, they're just sitting around waiting for the next job to come through.
So is it just an evolution that you have to be a generalist or a hybrid, and then potentially maybe you get to the specialist?
Well, I think they're creators, period, first and foremost. They're, you know, whether they're the director or not, they're a creator, and I think that the new age of directors coming through are just good at being really resourceful and finding a variety of ways to do something, and so that they don't always have to be the director. They can be really resourceful and be the producer, or they can, you know, the editor, or whatever it might be.
Because you can't be a hybrid and have $1 million budget and do everything yourself. That's impossible.
Yeah.
But, you know, where is that line in between where you can handle everything or most of it?
But maybe the experience of having done a lot of parts really lends to a better, deeper understanding of how it all works, and then you communicate with the people that you end up,
and you can be more efficient
really well.
As you,
right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Cool. Well, does anyone have any questions? Open up to.
Yeah. Hi. In the $10,000 number is interesting because if you look at a $10 CPM for views, that's $1 million. So $1 million gives you $10,000 of media budget, and that's quite a lot of views. I mean, there's not a lot of videos that really, you know, there's just the occasional $13 million viewer. So isn't the economics in the end of this type of content always going to be restricted just by those sheer hard economics of what you can actually get, whether it's a sponsorship or an advertiser dollar?
And everyone might disagree with me, but my sense when I'm hearing about these $10,000 budgets, the people, there's no way to quantify that number. They're not thinking about CPM. But since you clearly know somewhat about it, I'd be curious, when it comes to broadcast, what does $10,000 get you from a media buy perspective, and how does that equate to a production budget?
Yeah, I mean, I think but that's the issue with online. Mm-hmm. When you're running your video online and what you're going to basically be able to charge the advertiser for, mm-hmm. which is how you're going to monetize it. Mm-hmm. So you have a million views is a lot in the online world, and perhaps not so much in the on-air world. So the question of how do you expand the budget for videos in the online world is going to, in the end, surely come down to the views. I mean, Next New Networks, which I think is the organization that Google bought, that they're using, I believe, to drive their channels in terms of our audience, were in exactly that. So they had billions of views, but they had a hard job really making enough money to fund these myriad of productions that they were running at the time.
Yeah, because, I mean...
Well, I think the 80-20 model of production versus media is doesn't really translate as well to the online world, where it used to be you spent 80% of your budget on media buys on broadcast TV and 20% on the production of the video. But when you're getting a lot of your views for free online, and you really it's harder. I feel like that ratio just doesn't work anymore.
Agreed, and I think we're in a hybrid space figuring that out. I mean, at the end of the day, a $10 CPM for video is undervaluing the video, it's undervaluing the channel that the video is on, it's undervaluing the audience's attention. It's too low. It's way too low. And what we've seen with IAB banners for the past 10 years is that decrease in CPM is ultimately a race to the bottom, right? You ultimately end up with noise that consumers don't pay attention to. So our challenge as media, of course, is to push those CPMs back up to a place that's commensurate with the impact. That will mean a trickle down to to production budgets, of course. But more so what it means also is that the number of trusted voices will probably decrease and will the value of the filtering will be more important as people turn to channels where they're getting great content, advertising that makes sense to them and actually is suited to them and adds value in and of itself, right? That's ultimately how we solve that problem. And it's not, I mean, frankly, it's not going to happen tomorrow, but it's the train that we have to take.
Well, and I think also a view online can sometimes be worth a lot more than a view on TV commercials.
Yeah, absolutely. So absolutely. Because, well, especially because it's immediate. And this is the fundamental, you know, issue is that those broadcast advertising impression doesn't allow you to immediately click through to more information about a product. It doesn't allow you to immediately click through to buy that product. It doesn't immediately allow you to share that impression along with your friends. So it should be worth a lot less. The issue is scale, right? They have scale, and then they have a way of doing things which has been ensconced for 50 years, 60 years, which we're, you know, in the process of both trying to fight against and also trying to reform. Right, because I would be remiss if I didn't say we have television that's on television now. We have television that's coming. We have a series with HBO that's coming in the fall, you know, which is a subscription model, of course. But in any case, it's like the two have to come together.
That's a lot more basic question. Just a nugget, like a piece of information or advice that you would give somebody wanting to start up a YouTube video channel.
Who wants to take that one? What about a Vimeo channel?
I don't think I'm the appropriate person to answer that.
Blake, I'd like to hear from you. First, don't try to start a Vice channel because it doesn't work. The advice I would give them is that whatever they produce, whatever you produce as a creator, has to be representative of your point of view and your voice, right? You have to really do what motivates you. And the harsh reality of it is that for the most part, that isn't going to create any particular attention. But you can't go chasing what you think people want. You have to do what you want to do, because that's ultimately what will resonate with the people that matter on the other side, right? They're looking for passion, and they're looking for point of view, and they're looking for acumen and ability, not for hey, this guy or girl is doing the same thing as everybody else.
Yeah, I also add that, you know, the other side is building the audience. We've touched on that a bunch today. It's engagement. It's engaging with your audience. It's engaging with the community as much as possible. On Vimeo, you know, one of our facts, it's like our frequently asked questions, like, how do I get views? It's really not about views. It's really about making connections with people, because that's ultimately what's going to create a relationship, what's going to create sort of that lasting value of, you know, wanting to see your stuff because you're actually interested in not just the content, but you're actually interested in the person. So we always really value the personal connection as much as possible. It's not always possible for every filmmaker to go out and, like, talk to every single person, but when you get a comment on it, there is a comment field. People want to talk to you. They're interested in how you made it and what you did, and just that conversation, just responding to those people, goes so far. And we see that day in and day out, just the level of discourse and people communicating with each other and learning from each other. It's almost just about that in general sometimes, where it's so much, it's like, what did you shoot that with, 5D? You know, what's, you know, whatever it is, what would you edit? And those conversations are great. Sometimes they can be repetitive. We see that as well, but the engagement is really, really, really important. And so being as proactive as you can to communicate with people and to discuss and collaborate oftentimes as well, you know, these are kind of networks. You know, YouTube, Vimeo, they're networks. And it's like not a social network in a sense, but it sometimes can be. And so, yeah, you utilize that as much as possible because people are interested in helping each other out.
Wanted to touch more on the idea of crowdsourcing content because I think it's really interesting. Some of the examples that I've seen where they've done that is you think of like the Doritos Super Bowl commercial, right? That was actual a competition. But the idea where they had some money and it was maybe more instead of that 80-20, they flipped it and they were like, let's put a lot of money in the media to promote it and then we won't have that to pay that much for the video. Katy Perry had her song Peacock. They never released a music video to it, but then there was a very well-produced video that a fan made that got all of the hits because there wasn't an actual produced label video. So in terms of trying to reach that middle ground, do you think that sort of crowdsourcing part of it or making it part of the creative experience to obtain content from the audiences and rewarding them in some way is feasible, or is it not, or is it destined for failure? I'm just kind of interested because if we can't afford it, why not make it a creative process?
I can speak a little bit to that. Yeah, I mean, I think that's a brand's like perfect scenario. You get tons of people interacting and creating the stuff for you for free, and that's, you know, you can't really buy that. This Crash the Super Bowl, that contest is really interesting, and you know, it's an interesting model. You want people to create your ads for you, and if it's a competition, you have tens of thousands of people doing it, and three win. And so you have 10,000 commercials out there. And, you know, a lot of times it's exercise for filmmakers just to sort of compete and try. But it's really a big win for brands. And so what we like to do, we did this competition with Canon called Beyond the Still. And it was extremely successful, but it was not branded, really. It was creators making short films, and they link together through photographs at the beginning and the end. And there's nothing to do with Canon in any of the content, but it facilitated the creativity. You know, it was saying, this is a really cool crowdsourced type project. They put the film together, and it was shown at Sundance. And so, I mean, that's an interesting way. We like to do that model better because we don't like to just slap brands all over it. And that gets into the branded content thing, which we didn't really touch on too much today, which is facilitating filmmakers, not on a huge, massive scale, but it is. And so when brands can start seeing the value and align themselves just with creativity in general, you kind of see that with Intel and Vice, with the Creators Project, which I think is actually another interesting model, which
sure.
is sort of subsidizing the whole thing, not for any particular end goal, except for facilitating a lot of creative output.
Well, yeah,
I mean, obviously.
It's an interesting point. I don't know if people are familiar with the Creators Project, but it's a partnership, multi-year partnership that we have with Intel, where several years ago, Intel came to us and said, we need to re-engage with young consumers. We need to become relevant to Generation Y, essentially. How do we do that? We said, well, the thing that you need to do is demonstrate Intel's core sort of functionality to this audience. What do you guys do? You power every computer in the world, right, that is making a great film or is making a great piece of art. So we need to focus on the creators who are pushing the boundaries of art and technology forward, and pushing culture forward as a result of that, showcase their work, invite everybody to come in and to interact with it, and capture all of that in a website. Really, ultimately, that's driven by a business goal for Intel. Mm-hmm. But because we're able to get to it at a strategic level at the beginning to try to help them solve a business problem, we were able to bring it forward to a place where Intel is involved in every interaction, but it's not a kind of a transactional, okay, now go buy right. an Intel.
And can you talk specifically about what you guys are actually doing in terms of the content that you're creating? Because I think that's interesting in the events that you throw. You're
sure.
These
so, okay, through. So let's say we identify, in the first year, we identified 100 artists who were using technology to push the boundaries of art and culture forward. We made video pieces about them in 8 territories around the world, translating each of those pieces into the 8 languages where the creators around the world came from. Then we showcased those works in a series of traveling shows, essentially, that began in New York, went to London, went to Sao Paulo, went to Seoul, and then to Beijing, and invited the public in to interact with the artwork, to watch the videos, to take part in symposiums and conferences, and to broadcast all that stuff back out through the creatorsproject.com. What that does is it acts for as a magnet for Intel to talk to the press about what they're doing with their products moving technology forward. It creates a platform for the artists to publicize their work and to create attention for themselves and create connection with one another. It creates an opportunity for us to have a media channel that helps us aggregate audience. And, of course, for the audience, it creates a great experience where people come down, have an amazing time at a party, drink some beers, hang out with some art, meet some of the people that are involved in this as well as their peers and get excited and get engaged.
And you're paying the artists, correct?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of different models. On the one hand, there's a studio that funds artist projects. They apply to produce an idea that they want to do, and similar to Kickstarter, where Creators Project funds that, and we document the creation of those things. There is an instance where we're paying artists to create works that they already had in motion to so that they can be exhibited at the shows, and on the other hand, we're providing sort of seed dollars for them to work with other artists as well to create collaborative works. So it's a perfect scenario in a lot of respects. It's also a perfect scenario, which means that it's not going to happen all that often.
Yeah.
As much as we would like it to, right? I mean, it's a big strategy of ours to create more instances where that happens, but. Look, I mean, the takeaway there is that you have to align with brands at a strategic level.
Well, it's a great strategy, but if every single brand did that, then it also wouldn't work.
Well, I mean, cream rises to the top, right? Which is why you have to. And this is something I was going to say to your crowdsourcing question. I think the real problem with that crowdsourcing idea is that it gets real gimmicky real fast.
It's unsustainable. Because the cream rises to the top and the cream doesn't want to take part in those in spec work, basically, after doing it once or twice, generally.
And maybe taking that model and not making it such a large scale or having just the sort of the open flood of, and finding ways to twist that success and knowing that it's not going to happen again and again and hybriding it with sort of other, like, here's your 10 grand, use all traditional, like, payment methods and part, you know. So.
You know, sorry, what just occurred to me about the crowdsourcing thing, I think the crowdsourcing thing probably doesn't have a real long life, but what the advantage for the crowdsourcing thing right this minute is that people who take advantage of it have the opportunity to create notice for themselves out of it. There will be something that comes after the crowdsourcing thing. You, as a creator, have to take part in whatever that thing is as an opportunity to create notice for yourself. Then you have to do the next thing. I mean, ultimately, that's what I think the takeaway is. If you're an aspiring filmmaker, creator in this space, you have to take part in each one of these things because one or another will suit your capabilities better and will lead you down a path that is productive in some way. Because there isn't a model yet that where we know crowdsourcing videos, for instance, is going to create advertising for the future.
I think we have to wrap it up. But thanks, everybody.
Yeah, thank you.